Undisclosed comes to you this week because of Stamps.com and Blue Apron. Support our sponsors because they support us. Enjoy the podcast.
On the night of January 11th, 2000, shortly after the police discovered that Isaac's injuries came from a gunshot wound and not a car accident, the police began asking the question they should. Who would want to do such a thing? It didn't take much digging to turn their attention almost immediately towards Joey Watkins, Isaac's ex-girlfriend, ex-boyfriend. So they positioned their radar towards Joey as the investigation began. But first, they had to figure out exactly what happened on the night of the accident, pinning down Isaac's movements and examining what tale the crime scene had to tell.
Sometimes it feels like there just are not enough hours in the day, especially when you're working past the normal 9 to 5 hours. I mean, no one wants to use their lunch break to go sit in the post office. So if you're still making time-consuming trips to the post office, you need a better way. Use Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, get the postage you need the instant you need it. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. You'll save money with Stamps.com, too. It's just a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Even when we're investigating important cases, we all work around the clock. We don't have time to make trips to the post office, which is why we use Stamps.com. And right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You'll get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and digital scale. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com and enter UNDISCLOSED.
Welcome to episode 4 of Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
On today's episode, we are going to look at all the evidence and documents we have that help us figure out exactly what Isaac Dawkins did that night after he left Floyd College. Because before we can figure out who committed this murder, we have to figure out exactly what happened.
In the 1891 story, The Boscombe Valley Mystery, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson investigate the death of a man in the woods in Herefordshire, England. Shortly before the man's death, two eyewitnesses claim to have seen the man's estranged son following him into the woods with a gun in his hand, and the deceased, in fact, was found with an injury that very well could have been caused by blunt force trauma from the butt of a gun. The son becomes the prime suspect, both for the police and the community, until the daughter of the deceased's friend contacts Inspector Lestrade, believing the son to be innocent. When Sherlock Holmes arrives at the scene, he realizes that a mistake has been made. The cause of death was not the gun, but a jagged stone lying among the moss. According to Holmes, oh, how simple it would have been had I been here before they came like a herd of buffalo and wallowed all over it. Holmes is referring to the officers who processed the crime scene, and his assessment is probably pretty accurate for the time. According to Dr. Ian Burney, a historian at the University of Manchester, it wasn't until the 1920s that dedicated CSIs began to appear as supervisors of a complex police and scientific operation, accompanied by photographers and policemen to search and protect the scene. Before then, well-intending officers routinely contaminated crime scenes, leading to lost and misleading evidence. Now, interestingly, according to Dr. Burney, Sherlock Holmes and another fictional character, Dr. John Evelyn Thorndike, actually influenced the development of modern crime scene investigation, but even without that, Holmes was able to find the stone that eventually led him to discover the true identity of the murder. But sometimes, even with modern advances in crime scene investigation, mistakes are made. Sometimes eyewitnesses are handled wrong, the crime scene is compromised, the cause of death not recognized, the true killer ignored when the police pick a suspect and can't let him go.
We'll start by looking at the last known movements of the victim, Isaac Dawkins, eyewitnesses to events leading up to his death, and the crime scene. But let's start with when Isaac left school. Isaac's American history class at Floyd College was supposed to end at 7:15 p.m. that night on Tuesday, January 11th. But we don't know for sure if it ended at 7:15 or if, because it was the first day of classes for the spring semester, he got out early. There's evidence pointing both ways. But the last confirmed person to see Isaac alive was a woman named Amy Suddeth, a classmate who wasn't friends with him, but she knew him through a coworker and was in his American history class that evening.
We had a history class together with Dr. Robert Page.
Okay. Was that on the first day of college?
The very first day of class.
All right. Excuse me, first day of class.
Mm-hmm.
And Isaac was in the same class as you?
Mm-hmm.
Was that his last class of the day?
I would assume. We walked out of class together.
Did you see, well, first of all, where did you go? Or where did y'all go?
We walked out of the hallway, and he was like, hey, I know you, and we talked about how we knew each other, and then we got to the bookstore, and I went into the bookstore to buy my book for that class, and he said, okay, I'll see you next class, and I said, okay, see ya. And I'm assuming he walked through the cafeteria like he was going towards the front of the school to leave.
That's where the parking lot would
mm-hmm.
be. How was Isaac acting? And by that, I mean, did he seem to be upset? Did he seem to be nervous?
No, he didn't. He just seemed normal.
Do you recall about what time you left Floyd College January the 11th?
Yeah, it was around 7. It was like a 5:36 class. It was the first day of class, so we probably stayed the majority of class time.
Okay. You didn't stay the whole time, though? Professor let you go a little early?
Yeah, he may have let us go a little early.
Like Amy said, they could have gotten out at 7:15 or they could have gotten out a few minutes early because it was the first day of that class. And often, you know, first day of school, professors end classes a few minutes early. In other sources, there's kind of a more definitive 7:15 stop time, but it's never really firmly established. And given they talked to students the very next day on the 12th, you'd think they would have had an answer one way or another here. But we have no notes of the interviews that the police did on January 12th. With the professor of the class and his other classmates, so we can't really tell one way or another.
So Ferd assumed that class ended at 7:15 p.m., which is when it was scheduled to end. That means then Isaac immediately went out to his car. Was he seen doing something else? It would have been really helpful, obviously, to know exactly what time class ended, because then you can establish what time he left the college. But unfortunately, nobody seems to have gotten a firm answer. The police weren't able to pin that down, not even from the professor teaching the class himself.
Now, there's also one other weird thing about the testimony by Amy Suddeth, who, again, was Isaac's classmate in his American history class on January 11th. Now, at trial, Tammy Colston, the prosecutor, asked Amy, were you aware of any problems that Isaac had with anybody in school that day? And Amy's response was no. And now here's a clip, actually, of Amy testifying at the trial of Joy Watkins' co-defendant, Mark Free.
Had you seen Isaac in any disputes with anyone in class or in your presence there at Floyd College? Did he seem to get along with everybody?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know him. I knew of him, but I always thought that he was, you know, a super nice guy.
Did you see anybody picking a fight with him there?
No.
Did you see him picking a fight with him?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Suddeth.
So that's Amy testifying at Mark Free's trial, but if we look at other statements in the case, that doesn't seem to be entirely true. And that's because there was another student named Shauna, and she told Detective Moser that, quote, a friend named Amy Suddeth told her she heard that the victim talked to some friends in parking lot after class on 11:00, heard Joey might have been there.
After hearing that, Moser went and talked to Amy herself. And here were the notes of his interview with her say. That she was a student at Floyd, that she knew Isaac from the past, and that she walked out of class at the same time as Isaac. She says that she went to the school store while Isaac continued walking, and the notes say 7:15 is when got out of class. But again, we don't know if the question was, when did class end, or when did you get out that day? Anyway, Amy goes on to say, the day after, so January 12th, at the help desk, she heard an unknown white male state that this incident with Isaac was crazy, and that the victim had left school and was supposedly talking to his so-called friends, in quotes. And this unknown white male said he didn't see it himself, he just heard it from others. And apparently, according to Amy, this person also knew that the victim used to date an ex of Joey Watkins. She also says that the buzz at school was that Joey had done it. Now, again, like a lot of this case, it's a bunch of rumors, and I'm not going to put particularly high odds on there being anything behind it, but this is something you'd want to have checked out, right? By the time this interview with Amy happens, it's February, almost a month later.
But it's interesting that within that month that is a rumor that's already, or the buzz is already about Joey.
The next day it was. And also, Moser talked to the students in Isaac's American History class on the 12th. Why didn't the story come out then? Because Amy is saying she heard this the next day. She heard this from some person. And yet it was never apparently shared with investigators until some other student heard the rumor and passed it along to them. So while factually it's hard to say what relevance it has, I find it interesting in context with her testimony at the trials. It's less of an issue with her testimony at Mark Free's trial, in which she's only asked, did you see Isaac in a fight? And she says no, because she didn't. But at the first trial, Joey's trial, the question's a little more open-ended, and her answers seem a little bit more unstraightforward, I guess you could say, in light of these notes.
Yeah, I mean, at Joey's trial, the prosecutor asks Amy if she is aware of any problems that Isaac had with anybody in school that day, and it seems pretty clear that she had previously, in a prior statement, mentioned some type of incident in the parking lot after class on January 11th, and while that wouldn't be admissible at trial, it would be hearsay and couldn't be used to prove the truth of the matter asserted, there is a rule allowing for impeachment, attacks on the credibility of a witness based upon prior inconsistent statements. And it at least seems here there's some inconsistencies. And as we'll get to later with the timeline, those inconsistencies seem pretty implausible for Joey to actually have been there at Floyd College on January 11th.
Mostly, I just wish that the story had come out on the 12th and that someone could have checked it out then. Because while it's probably just another rumor, which, like most rumors in this case, is baseless and just totally made up because someone felt like it, maybe there's something to it. But there's no way now, or even back in February of 2000, to figure that out.
So, I mean, like, there's two things that, you know, we can get from Amy that there might or might not have been something happening with Isaac right after class between him and somebody else, maybe a white man, like, we don't know. And also what time he was left. But she was definitely the last person, apparently, to have seen him at school that day.
And she's also evidence that even the next day, even at a school that Joey didn't attend, it was already being passed around student to student that Joey had something to do with it and that Joey had done it out of revenge.
So at some point then, Isaac leaves the school. And it's really important to pin these minutes down because the minutes are going to matter in this case. And we're going to get more in depth on why those minutes matter with cell phone records and where Joey was that night. But for now, we have to try to figure out exactly when the accident took place, when he was allegedly shot, and when he was seen on the road.
Yeah, but in terms of Amy overall, while obviously we're noting now those minutes are important, Stanley Sutton, who came onto the case to investigate, interviewed Amy 7 months later, and apparently for him at least, the minutes weren't important because in his notes about Amy, he wrote only, Sutton, Amy Suddeth, talked with her. She walked out with Isaac into parking lot of Floyd College. They had American history. She could remember the time. But despite him writing in his notes she could remember the time, he doesn't specify the actual time she remembered, so it doesn't actually tell us all these months later what time she remembers, though, of course, in the earlier notes it said 7:15 p.m.
Yeah. Witness can remember. Don't ask witness what they remember. Thanks, Sutton.
Susan, can I ask you, did she testify to what time she saw him?
At Joey's trial, she says approximately 7 o'clock. At Mark's trial, she says class got out at 7:15, but it's likely we got out a few minutes early because it was the first day. The next time Isaac is seen is approximately 1 mile north of Floyd College. Now, Isaac lived up in Armerchi, which is on the north side of Rome, and Floyd College is on the south end, both along 27. So Isaac got in his truck, started driving north, and was next seen about a mile later by a man named Wayne Benson. Wayne Benson worked in Cedartown, but lived in Rome, and he'd gotten off work around, it's not clear, 6:30, 6:45, and was driving up back home when he suddenly saw an odd interaction between two cars in the northbound lane. Benson first encountered Isaac's truck a little under a mile north of Floyd College and about 1.7 miles south of where Isaac's truck would ultimately wreck. During that 1.7 miles, between where Mr. Benson first encountered Isaac's truck and the wreck site, there was only ever one other car near Isaac's truck, a little bluish four-door sedan that Mr. Benson thought was a Honda, something like that. Here's his testimony at Mark Free's trial.
When you got into Rome, did you see anything, any unusual incident out on the highway?
Yes, sir, on the way home I did.
All right. Tell us what you saw, Mr. Benson.
About a mile, I guess, north of Floyd College, I came around a curve right there at, I believe it's North Georgia Camper, and there was a white pickup truck just for some unknown reason in the outside lane just stopped. So I stopped, and as the truck stopped, a little blue car in front of it darted off to the side of the road.
And now, just, when you say, excuse me, the truck you think was stopped in the traffic lane?
Yes, sir.
On the left-hand side?
Well, on the right-hand
side. Yeah, on the right side.
Right-hand side coming into Rome.
Outside lane?
Yes, sir.
That'd be as you're heading north?
Yes, sir.
All right. And where was this little car?
It was, first I come aware of the little car is when the truck stopped. I didn't know why the truck stopped. And just as soon as he stopped, the little blue car darted off to the on the right-hand shoulder of the road. And the white truck increased its speed and took off.
The white truck is stopped in the middle, it's like the sort of like the left side of 27, is that right?
So the white truck stopped in the right lane, on the outside lane. That's the first thing he notices. He sees brakes lights. He has to like pull up short to the like rear end Isaac's truck. And right after that happens, he sees a little blue car that was in front of the truck suddenly pull off into the shoulder. When I first heard this, I guess my first thought was, wait, I thought that Joey was supposed to have pursued and killed Isaac. So why is Isaac's truck behind the blue car when Benson first sees it? Because if Benson's to be believed, the blue car has to be the shooter. So how come Isaac's truck is behind the blue car? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, unless Benson didn't come upon them like early enough, maybe before he approached the two cars, there was already something going on. I've seen teenagers do that where they're kind of, you know, being aggressive towards each other, kind of trying to cut each other off on the road and mess around. It could be that that was already happening and then Isaac got in front of the blue car, like by the time Benson caught up to them.
Yeah, I think something clearly happened before Benson got there. But to the extent there's a story at trial, the story is that Joey was following Isaac. So why would Joey have pulled ahead of Isaac if he was following him?
And this is only, as you said, Susan, about a mile north of Floyd College. So, you know, assuming that Joey is pursuing Isaac, that's not that much time for him to somehow have gotten ahead of him. And then this whole cat and mouse game starting. So, I mean, I guess it's possible, but it seems a bit odd with what Benson is describing, how that fits with the state's theory of the case.
Does Benson tell us how fast he was going and how fast he approximately thinks the other cars are going?
Speed limit. Not slow, not fast. At Joey's trial, Benson said that when he first saw how Isaac's truck and the little blue car were maneuvering, he figured it was a girlfriend-boyfriend dispute or something.
What happened then?
Well, I didn't, not knowing what the little blue car was going to do, I just sort of slowed down, you know, and it sped off also. And the white truck got into the inside lane, and I think about probably 3 to 4 tenths of a mile of the traffic light at Walker Mountain. The little blue car had caught the truck there. They run side by side at the traffic light.
What happened next?
The two cars, they were running sort of side by side. The blue car might have been just a little behind the white truck going up the hill right there about the Coca-Cola plant, I believe. And all of a sudden, for some reason, the little white truck disappeared off the road. It crossed the media and got in the southbound lane traveling north. It ran that way probably, I would say, 3 tenths of a mile or more. And then it finally hit a guardrail. It ran up against the guardrail and followed the guardrail to the end. And at the end of the guardrail, the guardrail sort of goes into the ground. The little truck reared up on the guardrail, and it caused the truck to flip over at least one time and continued to back up right.
And again, according to Benson, there's no one else around when this happens. He's behind Isaac's truck and little blue Honda.
Like I said earlier, I was probably 3 to 4 tenths of a mile behind them. I wasn't, you know, right on their bumper because they were under the light and I had to slow down for the light. So they got ahead of me just a little distance.
Yeah. But there was other cars around them as well?
Not right up on them, I wouldn't think, best I can recall. You know, best I can recall after they got, like I said, the little blue car and the truck, the last time I actually saw them close together, they were side by side. The blue car had caught the truck at the traffic light. They were side by side. They went under the traffic light. And then the white truck took off, and then they were running. I would say, this is the truck. They were running about like this. This being the blue car. The last time I came aware of them, up on top of the hill before the truck left the road.
Okay. And you actually saw the truck leave the road?
Yes, sir, I sure did.
Which means, with no other cars around, then if Benson's memory is right, and if Isaac was shot from another moving vehicle, then this blue Honda-ish car had to have been the shooter. Which means Joey, if he was the shooter, or with the shooter, had to have already been following Isaac's truck no later than 1 mile north of Floyd College.
So Benson saw the car go off the road. Was he one of the first people to make a 911 call then?
We think he was the first 911 caller. He was one of the two 911 recordings we have. Again, for some reason, they were not all saved. But Benson has identified the first call and the call we opened episode one with as his voice.
On Floyd 911.
You've had an accident right over here on 27 South, right close to Alcan.
27 South, next to Alcan.
It's interesting to me that when he's asked if there's other cars on the road, it's not an immediate, oh no, there's nothing there. I mean, he's almost seeming to suggest that maybe there were, but not close by or something, but he doesn't, and the police don't ask him.
See, they do actually. And he, in his first statement about this, he does give it a firm no, nothing in between the victim and Mr. Benson when the victim left the roadway. So this is 2 years later at Mark's trial, he gives that answer. But prior to that, he was always very clear that it was just him, Honda-ish, blue car, and Isaac's truck. When I first started looking at this case and trying to put these statements together, part of me wonders, like, did Mr. Benson see what he thought he saw? Is this a reliable statement that we can depend upon? Because if he's right, then, I mean, if Benson's right, it does resolve the very central question of who shot Isaac. Answer, it's whoever's in that little blue car.
Okay, so it was dark that night. We're talking about January. So after 7 p.m. It's going to be dark, and I don't know how well that road is lit. So I'm going to assume that even though he might have been able to see the cars and maybe see like the shape and the color, that he wouldn't have been able to see like how many people were sitting in the car or anything like that, right? Did he have any more details?
He did not. So one thing I thought was interesting, though, is that he thought that he didn't get a tag, he didn't get the license plate, but he did notice it wasn't a dealer plate. It wasn't the bright yellow or bright red of a dealer plate. So it was a regular tag, whatever was on there. But what's also interesting, though, is that Mr. Benson didn't immediately connect this crash with the blue car because it doesn't seem like he brought it up in his statement when he talked to police that night. We don't know what he said to the police. There's no notes about it. His name is written down on the initial police report suggesting that he had, in fact, talked to cops on the scene, but it does not seem like he was telling them, oh, yeah, that truck went off the road because something happened with that blue car. That blue car ran it off. That blue car... It seems like he dodged a wreck, like possibly Isaac had fallen asleep at the wheel.
But the blue car didn't stop, right? It just kept going.
See, this is the part where I don't think Mr. Benson has a clear memory. He assumes it kept going, but as he puts it, I mean, his eyes were on the truck. When he saw the truck veer off across the median and go into the southbound lane, that's all he was looking at. He was not trying to watch his blue car.
We're going to take a short break so we can hear about one of our amazing sponsors. Okay, look, I love my husband. He's a great guy. But the truth is, for all the time we've been married, I do the bulk of the cooking. Tonight, something changed. My husband, for the first time in a long time, decided to make dinner, and he made it because he was really excited that we had gotten our first shipment of Blue Apron. In case you haven't heard of it, Blue Apron is this amazing home delivery service of prepackaged meals, and they're not just meals, they're all the ingredients, fresh, organic, locally and ethically sourced ingredients that come to you, delivered to your door, and it came, by the way, in a refrigerated package with all the fresh ingredients we could need for every single meal. You get three meals for the week for your family or for a couple, and they come with recipe cards, these beautiful recipe cards with pictures on them. Step by step, you can make an entire meal, and usually in about half an hour. And we're talking about restaurant quality meals. My husband was so proud of himself. He made this amazing endive and cucumber salad with a delicious shallot vinaigrette and some goat cheese and plum jam sandwiches. And by the way, he made that jam himself. For this week's delivery, I chose all vegetarian options, but there's so much that they have on their website, and you can decide what meals you want. In the upcoming month in August, they have all kinds of great meals that they're offering, like spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad, chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. I just kind of like saying chicken tinga tacos, but anyway. Summer vegetable and quinoa bowls with eggplants, shishito peppers, and corn. And when you've got a family to feed, obviously it has to be affordable, and Blue Apron is. We're talking about less than $10 per person per meal. And you know that you can't even get a meal at a fast food joint at that price point. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. This is an offer especially for our listeners. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So please don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. I can't wait to see what my husband cooks for the rest of this week.
Now, in the very first reports on Isaac's crash and the subsequent death and murder investigation, it was stated that Isaac's crash into the pine thicket off of Highway 27 occurred at 7:18 p.m. This was also included in a press report issued by the Rome Police Department on January 12th. But by the time that Joey's case got to trial, the state is saying that essentially everything happened at approximately 7:20. Now, I know that probably doesn't sound like that big of a difference, and we'll be addressing all this in more detail in the next few episodes, but for now, just remember this. Minutes matter in this case. What time the wreck was is a big deal for a lot of reasons. And for some reason we can't quite explain, there's an extreme shortage of documents showing the exact minutes at which certain events occurred.
If I'm going to be thinking about this, I'm going to think, well, I mean, if Benson was the first one to make a call, couldn't we establish from, let's say, his cell phone records, like what time that call was made? It had to have been fairly shortly. But if we're talking about a difference of 2 minutes, I mean, he could have waited a couple minutes before he made that call, and then it still would have been a little bit difficult, I guess, to pinpoint it down.
But if it's earlier, that matters. And it's interesting because an investigator with the Floyd County Police did go to Mr. Benson and ask him what his phone number was, what his phone carrier was. Not sure why. If they used it in anything, they didn't include it in the file.
Maybe we could use the word perplexing.
A little bit perplexing.
Yeah. But for some reason, like you said, we don't have those cell phone records. We don't know what time the call was made.
We don't have the 911 records either, which would probably be the easy thing to get. We have the 911 records beginning with 7:50 p.m., like the actual computer records from 911 calls that show the second that the call hits the line and the second it's answered and how long it lasts and who made it and all that good stuff. But for some reason, they didn't think to pull the records for 40 minutes earlier, the time of the wreck.
So the calls that came in 40 minutes later, they were just calls to, like, what, dispatch, ambulances, and that?
No. So when you call 911, it records all of those calls, and it passes them out to one of the various stations they have. People answer the phone. But it shows you, I mean, the caller and all those times. And they did print out those records beginning with 7:50 p.m. that night for about 10, 15 minutes. So the records were for sure available, for sure obtainable, but they didn't get them.
So sometime around 7:18 to 7:20, in those couple of minutes, Isaac has gone off the road and his truck has crashed. When the police arrive at the crime scene, do we know what time they arrive?
We know what time the radio handwritten traffic logs as they arrived. But again, we'll get into more later, there's problems with that. But 722. The fire trucks, or at least one of the fire engines, likely arrived first, because they were very close, like a quarter of a mile away. And their handwritten arrival time is 7:23 p.m. And the cops say when they got there, the fire engine already was there on the scene, but their handwritten logs show they got there at 7:22. So
maybe somebody's watch was off?
I just think the handwritten logs aren't clocks and shouldn't be used that way.
Right.
As we noted in episode one, the crime scene wasn't initially secured or processed because of a misunderstanding about what led to the car crash in this case. So this is from Lieutenant Burnett's investigation summary of the case. According to Lieutenant Burnett, due to the initial report that the incident was a traffic accident, the crime scene had been unsecured for about 2 hours. Numerous persons had walked through the crime scene. There was little evidence to collect at the scene other than the measurements, the window with the bullet hole, and the vehicle itself.
I mean, it seemed like from some of the 911 calls that it were people who witnessed the accident who actually went up and were trying to see if he was okay, whether he was breathing or not.
There were a lot of people there. One of the investigators writes that there was a crowd of 10 to 15 people lingering around by the time they were on the scene, as Mr. Benson described them to me, a bunch of looky-loos. And there were also several people that had tried to assist Isaac immediately after the wreck. Mr. Benson remembers walking up to the truck and seeing a laptop laying out on the ground. So he picked it up and put it in the trunk bed just to make sure it didn't get stepped on or lost during the commotion. And after the firefighters got there, they tried to open the doors to get to Isaac. And there was the EMS. And then there were police. And then here's a question we still can't answer. This truck was out there and the investigation was ongoing from about 7:18 to approximately 10:30 to 11. That's unheard of for a wreck, or even a crime scene. Although, obviously, you'd hope a crime scene would get more methodical attention. Usually, a wreck isn't left there with active investigators swarming around for 3 hours. And I've talked to investigators, I've talked to people up there now. I'm still not sure why it was left there for so long. For a regular crash, you'd expect to be cleared up within an hour. But they didn't even find out that Isaac had been shot for nearly 2 hours. And yet, the truck was still there. Now, they don't know it's a crime scene. They don't know to secure it. So presumably they would have treated it like a wreck, which is why it's odd the truck was still sitting there after all that time.
Yeah, if they think this is a single car accident for an hour and a half, I don't know why that truck is still sitting there after all that time. I mean, certainly if they thought it was a homicide, they would have processed the scene more. But obviously from all the evidence here, they didn't for that first hour and a half realize it was a homicide.
And just trying to figure out who did what at the crime scene is next to impossible. We know roughly who was there. We know the names of the officers. We have their reports, their, well, limited sketches. But we really have next to no documentation concerning the crime scene itself, which means that witness memories are the only thing we really have to go on in reconstructing what happened there and how it was processed. But relying on witness statements to reconstruct a crime scene, well, if you remember Colin's discussion of the Rashomon effect from season one, it's that all over again. At first glance, it doesn't seem like the statement of any one witness can be reconciled with the statements of any other, and we have at least four statements about the crime scene to compare here. To show what's going on, let's take a couple of specifics about the crime scene. There are two things in particular that have been driving me bonkers for 7 months now: the back window of Isaac's truck and the crime scene photos. Starting with the back window, here's what we know. Isaac's truck was a single cab white 1994 Toyota pickup. The top had some damage on it, presumably from a rollover, which a few witnesses recall seeing, and the passenger side window was busted out. His truck had a four-pane sliding glass back window, consisting of a frame with two fixed pieces on either side to left and right, and two sliding pieces in the center. A hole was discovered in one of these sliding panes. We've got exactly one piece of documentation on this window, though. That's an inventory sheet showing that it was collected at 10:25 p.m. on January 11th by Captain Marshall Smith with the Rome Police Department. That was 3 hours, over 3 hours, after the wreck, And, of course, the inventory sheet identifies the crime it was collected in conjunction with its murder, which means it wasn't even filled out until at least the next day when Isaac died. We also have a single, unfocused photo of this window pane, but I've got a lot of questions about what the photo is actually showing. Supposedly, it's depicting the middle sliding pane closer to the driver's side of the cab, but there's no proof of that I've seen. There's just this blurry photo of a blurry figure holding up a blurry glass pane against an indeterminate spot along an even blurrier window frame in the dark with bad lighting. And that's kind of it. I mean, yeah, the hole looks like a bullet hole, so maybe that's how Isaac was shot, but no one ever even attempted to line up the bullet hole with the bullet wound in Isaac's head to see how they lined up or if they lined up at all. So why does this even matter? Why do we care where the window pane was found or what condition it was in or who found it? We have a victim with a gunshot wound in the head and a hole in the window of his truck. So 1 + 1 = 2, right? Well, given the mass of contradictory witness statements in this case about how Isaac was shot, knowing how that bullet actually entered Isaac's truck would have been pretty significant. On the other hand, evidence confirming which window Isaac had been shot through would have necessarily disproven the statements of a majority of the witnesses who claimed to have knowledge of the shooting. So, if you're the state, I guess that's kind of inconvenient. See, the state relied on a lot of different versions of how exactly Isaac was shot. To give just a few examples, in October of 2000, the state used one version of the shooting to get a wiretap on Joey and one of his alleged accomplices. They used an entirely different version of events in November of 2000 in order to have Joey arrested. And they used yet an even more different version of events at trial in June of 2001. Let's take the story that the police finally used 10 months later, in November, to arrest Joey, and which Sutton presented as a fact at Joey's preliminary hearing. Just prior to Joey's arrest, on November 9th, Paul Allen, a former friend of Joey's, and one of the people at Breanne's house during the night of the Panama City incident, came to the police with a story. He said that he'd heard from his friend Lacey that she'd heard from her friend Josh, that Josh had told her that he and Joey and a boy named Tim Hughes, that's Joey's sister's boyfriend, had shot Isaac together. This statement was a big deal because 4 days later, as a result of follow-up interviews the police conducted in response to Paul's statement, Joey and Mark would be arrested for Isaac's murder.
And let's go back again and tell me one more time what she told you about this incident.
She said that they were at Josh, or she was at Josh's, and
Josh who?
Flemister.
Okay.
And he said that he'd tell her, you know, he's in real big trouble, in real big trouble. And later that night, he got drunk and told her that he was with Joey Watkins and Tim Hughes the night they shot Isaac. And she said, Josh said that they were going down 27, and Joey was trying to scare him or something, and shot, and the first shot knocked out his back window. And when he shot a second time, it hit him in the back of the head. And then she didn't say anything else after that. She said, you know, that Josh left to go to Virginia. To, you know, he had a job there or something.
Is that what he had told her?
Right.
And okay, yes. First off, I know you're probably confused right now and wondering why a statement about how Joey, Josh, and this guy Tim committed the murder could have possibly resulted in Joey and Mark being arrested for the murder. But for now, all I can say is don't worry about it. The police will fix that part of the story before they make any arrest. They weren't interested in Josh or Tim, and they found a way to fix the story and to turn it into evidence against Mark instead. So just ignore all the names for now. Secondly, let's look at another witness story, this time from a man named James Paul Cooley, who was in jail with Joey in the months leading up to the trial. For reasons we still don't know, he was ultimately a no-show at trial, although the prosecutor, Tammy Colston, was able to admit key evidence by representing to the court that he would later be testifying. He never showed, but here's what he said in a statement in February of 2001.
From the way he's told me, but I'm not sure on that.
Okay.
But they turned around there at the BP and followed him, you know, back towards town. And as he started around them, he said Mark shot at him once and it went through the back window. And then he shot again, from my understanding, through the side window.
And lastly, here's Todd Beckstein's version of the shooting. This statement was used at Mark's trial, and it was also used by Stanley Sutton to obtain a 3-week-long wiretap against the Watkins family phone line.
Did they both of them get out of their vehicle, their truck?
What Mark said is Joey got out first.
went up to the passenger side. As he was going up to the passenger side, Mr. Free got out, walked up. I mean, he went up to the driver's side. Mr. Free walked up on the passenger side. Joey got Isaac's attention by talking to him, and Isaac had the back of his head turned this way, out, turned to the left so that he could talk to Joey, and that's when Mark shot him. He fired two shots.
Like I said, don't worry about the names at this point. Just remember this. We have about as many different versions about what window Isaac was shot through as we have witness statements on it. And just look at the three versions we just played here. In one of them, Joey shoots out the back window of Isaac's truck, and then he shoots through the now blown out window and hits Isaac. In the second, Isaac's back window is shot, but the bullet misses, but then he's shot again, this time through the passenger window. And in the third, Isaac's truck was pulled over to the side of the road, and he is then shot twice through the passenger side window. This is why the crime scene discrepancies are such a big deal. Joey was arrested as a direct result of the story about Josh saying that Joey had shot out the back window of Isaac's truck and then shot again through the now open window. Wiretaps were obtained on the basis of the story about how there are two shots coming from the passenger side window. And because there's little documentation about the crime scene and only vague kind of statements about what windows might have been shot and how, it made it a lot easier for all these batshit crazy stories to move the case against Joey forward. Like I said, though, here's what we do know. At the crime scene, somewhere, a window pane was found with a hole in it. As for where exactly it was found, or who found it, or the condition it was in, or when it was found, well, the general assumption has been that when Isaac's truck wrecked, it flipped over at least once. And at that point, the entire frame of the truck's window, like the frame, the glass, everything, it all popped out of the seal, landing so that it fell apparently upright against some pine saplings, not too far from Isaac's truck, maybe about 10 feet. Here's Captain Marshall Smith with the Rome Police Department describing this at Mark's trial.
Okay, Marshall, in this area here, the rear window area, did you take that area out yourself or did it pop out one something?
It is already out. You can see it in one of the photographs. It's over to the left-hand side of the truck in the pine trees. It's just sitting there.
You're saying it appeared to have popped out on impact?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? It was laying out to the side?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, Marshall, there's an area right here.
Yes, sir.
Side. Is that it?
Yes, sir.
That's a good 6-7 feet away from it. Would it not be?
Yes, sir. I would think it's that or maybe a little greater.
And it's true that at some point that night, a photo was taken showing the whole back frame of Isaac's back window propped against some pine saplings. But here's the problem. Marshall Smith didn't arrive on the scene until quite a while after the accident, and there isn't a single person who arrived shortly after the crash who has any memory of Isaac's back truck window having popped out of the seal like this. The closest it gets is a couple witnesses who remember that, after the wreck, Isaac was on his hands and knees in the truck's cab with his right arm dangling outside the back of the truck, into the actual bed of the truck. But that could have happened if either the whole window had popped out of the seal, or if just the sliding glass pane had. And in contrast to Marshall Smith's testimony, at least one witness has a very strong memory of the back window having still been in the truck when he got there. 6 minutes after police arrived at the scene, they radioed for a tow truck, and Terry Ferguson, who was a tow truck driver on call that night, showed up not long after. His memory is that the back window of Isaac's truck was still in there when he got there, but that the sliding glass in the middle was open.
But the glass, I still say that that glass was in the back of that truck. And my youngest boy says it, too.
What glass?
The back window of the truck. Because I specifically asked, I'm pretty sure it was Marshall Smith. I said, after they said he'd been shot, I said, how did he get shot? And he was saying the only thing he could recognize is they were going down the road this way and he shot, and it went through the open sliding glass window and hit him in the head. So something's real fishy with this case. Cause I could have swore that glass was in that truck.
What do you mean, like in the truck still? Like in the back of the bed?
Yeah. No, in...
In place.
Still in the truck.
Still in place.
Because we would have to pick the step up.
So what's going on here? Best I can figure, there's one of two options. First, the entire back window frame popped out at the rubber seal when Isaac's truck rolled over, just like Marshall Smith said. Or two, the pane of glass that had been shot fell out when the truck rolled over, and later on, the back window frame was removed whole somehow, maybe during rescue efforts by the fire department. But the only evidence about this that was introduced at trial came from Captain Smith. He remembers that he found the window after going to the crime scene because Lieutenant Debbie Burnett had told him that it was a shooting.
Now, Marshall, in connection with January the 11th, at some point in the evening of January the 11th, were you called out to a wreck scene out on U.S. 27?
Yes, I was.
Well, why were you called out?
My lieutenant at the time was Lieutenant Debbie Burnett, and she had received some information that it wasn't really a wreck in itself, that the person driving the car had been shot.
Now, did you go about inspecting the scene?
I looked around the scene a little bit, and I discovered the back glass of the truck. I inspected the back glass to see maybe if I could determine what had happened there, and there was a bullet hole through the back of the glass.
So Marshall thinks that Debbie Burnett told him it was a shooting and that he then found the window. But there's another version of events to contend with. That's from Officer Hank Jackson. He was one of the first two officers at the scene that night, and he doesn't recall seeing Marshall there. He says he could have missed him. It doesn't mean he wasn't there. But Jackson also remembers being there when the window was found. He remembers Lieutenant Burnett coming to the wreck site and announcing to everyone there that it was a shooting, and then he looked over and found the glass with a hole in it. Here's Hank Jackson from his interview with Claire earlier this year, talking about his surprise at learning the wreck was actually a shooting, and then finding the window with a bullet hole in it.
I'm thinking the truck is facing southbound, and the back window would have been north of it, like it stopped, and the window just kept going, continuing, and it went north. That's what I'm thinking, but it was off to the side of the truck. It wasn't laying in the bed of the truck. It was actually physically on the ground.
Okay. And when did you first notice the window?
When, at the time, it was a Lieutenant Burnett, came up, and she said at the hospital that they discovered the driver had a bullet wound to the head. And so I'm thinking, well, if he's going northbound, somebody probably shot him from the side or from the back. And then I look, I see the window on the ground, and then I see the hole in the window.
So even though the window was not in the truck, you didn't actually notice where it was until after Debbie Burnett came and... Okay.
And here's Claire showing Hank Jackson our only photo of the truck's window at the crime scene.
So this is it in the woods. It's a little hard to tell, but there's
not a very good picture.
No, but this is the window back in the woods.
Yeah, that looks like it's shattered. But I can't tell if that looks like some kind of foliage or something. I don't know.
This is the bullet hole in the middle here, and then it's sort of shattered around there. So you don't remember looking at this?
I thought the whole window was kind of broken up. To me, this right here looks like this side and this side is not damaged, and the center is completely shattered. I don't remember. I don't remember that. But I remember seeing the bullet hole, because when she came up and said something, I was real amazed, and things started clicking about, well, yeah, it makes sense now. I know why he's on the wrong side. Or he's trying to get away, or he's shot. And then when she says that, I said, well, I wonder if it came through the side, and we start looking at the truck, about the side window if it broke or whatever, and I don't remember if they were. And then we see the back glass, and I remember seeing that bullet hole in that back glass. But I thought the whole window was fragmented.
Both sides?
Yeah, I thought it was, yeah.
Now, this interview was from 2016, so it's no surprise that the photos don't perfectly match now Sergeant Jackson's memory of what the scene looked like that night. But while we had in no way expect him to remember every detail of the crime scene, his memory of finding the bullet hole seems so clear. I mean, yes, his memory in this point could be faulty, but in general, Hank Jackson seemed very observant, and he was very clear about what he could and could not remember about the crime scene. And while we can't rule out the possibility that this is a false memory, I also can't find any reason to think that his memory is somehow less correct on this point than Marshall Smith's. And then we get back to Terry Ferguson. He was on the scene early, he thinks, and he stayed until the very end, when he towed the truck away. And yet, he doesn't recall ever seeing a bullet hole in the window, at any point.
If they would have saw that window with a bullet hole, why would they work it as a wreck?
That's what I don't understand. It must be that nobody saw the bullet hole until after 9 o'clock.
when they learned from the hospital that it was a shooting. And how can that be? How can you be at the crime scene for an hour and 40 minutes and not see the bullet hole in the window? Even if it's dark, they have flashlights.
Well, we got big floodlights on the trucks that light up the whole area.
Was everyone shocked when they called in as a shooting?
He did. He was hollering and screaming, telling me to get away from the truck. Because I done had the truck hooked up and was pulling it up on... I done got into the truck and put it in neutral and was pulling, fixing to pull it up on the bed. Actually, I done had the tires on the bed. And he started hollering and screaming. I thought somebody shot him, but he was hollering.
They wouldn't have gotten pictures before that, do you think?
Oh, I think...
They did?
They called. Well, they intended to, because they called Collier at 8:26 or whatever time I said.
And they didn't know by
then? Well, I think they probably were just getting pictures for a run-of-the-mill wreck at that point, right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Clive Carter had been taking pictures for the city and county for years and years. But if he took that picture, he should have stopped it.
So, if Terry is right, it means something important. There were never any photos taken of the crime scene after it was known to be a crime scene. According to Terry, the truck had been moved, two wheels onto his wrecker, before anyone at the scene learned it was a crime scene. That's a big if, though. I still have no idea what to make of Terry's memory of events. But then again, Hank Jackson and Captain Marshall Smith also seem to give mutually exclusive versions of what happened. Here's Claire and I during one of our early debates about what to make of Terry's statements.
Continue on US 41 south for 3 miles.
Totally convinced his memory about that window is accurate? I'm not convinced his memory about that window is accurate.
I'm not either, but his logic makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah.
Like, so if his memory is right... Which it might not be. But if he's right, those photos were all taken before anyone knew this was a murder case. Or a shooting case.
Well, I'm not...
Convinced about that?
So certain about that. Because we know that the call-out for Clyde Collier was not made until like 8... Well, I have to double-check. If it's 8:36, that's...
I think they found out about 9...
They found out at right about 9 that it was a murder.
Mm-hmm.
So if Collier is called at 8:36, and you know we were at Collier's house, it would take a decent little while to get there. So he's probably arriving there right about the time they find it's a murder.
I mean, he seemed to have a very clear memory of putting the car onto his wrecker and then having Marshall start hollering.
Oh, right. Right.
Which could be wrong, but...
So maybe he gets there, takes the pictures of the car, and then shortly thereafter, Terry loads it up. But the strange thing to me is Debbie Burnett saying that she gets on scene at 9:10 and Marshall Smith wasn't there. And she called him and he came back.
Use the right lane to take the US 411 ramp, then sharp left onto Georgia 20 East.
Doesn't make any sense. But here's one more point in favor of Terry's memory. When Claire and I spoke to him in 2016, this wasn't the first time in 16 years that he'd been asked to talk about this wreck and remember it. He'd actually answered questions about it maybe a half dozen times now. And the first time he was questioned about it was actually only a week or so after the shooting. He didn't know if it was an officer, he thought it was an attorney or something, but it's clear people were curious about what he remembered about picking up this truck very shortly after it happened. And here's another point in Terry's favor. This one from Marshall Smith's trial testimony in 2002.
You went out there and inspected the scene and did what you had to do. What did you do then?
I left for a short time and went to the hospital.
Right. When you got there, did you learn of his condition, Isaac's condition?
Yes, sir, I did.
Right. After that, did you go back to the scene?
Yes, sir. I went back to the scene, and they were still there, and the tow truck just had got there. And matter of fact, he hadn't even hooked up yet. He was getting ready to hook up, and that's when I collected the rear glass and kept it intact the best I could.
At first, this part of Captain Smith's testimony seemed pretty innocuous. But when I read it again after speaking with Terry Ferguson, it really stood out to me because what Captain Smith is saying here can't be true. He says that after learning that Isaac had been shot, he went back to the scene around the same time the tow truck got there. But the tow truck was called at 7:26. It would have been on the scene for at least an hour before Captain Smith returned there. And in fact, the vehicle impound form, which notes that Rabbits was towing the vehicle, was filled out at 8:32 p.m., still a half hour before the shooting was discovered, and 4 minutes before someone radioed dispatch and told them to call for a photographer. And yet Marshall Smith testified that when he returned to the crime scene, at no sooner than 9:30-ish, the tow truck was only just arriving and hadn't hooked up yet. So we wanted to talk to Marshall Smith and figure out what was going on here, see if maybe he could clarify what had happened or help us figure out why Terry Ferguson has such a different memory from the official record. Unfortunately, it didn't help too much. Here's what he remembers now.
Okay, so what did Marshall say about the wheels, or about the rollback?
When I just now spoke to him on the phone, he said that he really had a very, very minor role in the case. He did not get contacted until after they realized it was a shooting. And when he got out there, the truck, little white Toyota, was already loaded onto the rollback.
Again, this is 16 years later, but the fact that Marshall Smith doesn't recall being at the crime scene until after Isaac's truck was already on the rollback is the exact opposite of his trial testimony, in which he says over and over again that the tow truck hadn't hooked up yet when he arrived. Okay, to break that all down, we have on one hand Terry Ferguson, the tow truck driver, who remembers the back window frame being on the truck when he got there, and the middle window being open, but he doesn't remember seeing a bullet hole at all. He also remembers having Isaac's truck loaded up at the same time Marshall Smith learned it was a shooting. Hank Jackson's version, which has Lieutenant W. Burnett arriving to announce that this wreck was really a shooting, and then Hank Jackson finding the bullet hole in the window. Second, we have Captain Smith's version, which has him returning to the crime scene after learning at the hospital that it was a shooting, and then he finds the bullet hole in the window. Actually, there's also a third police version too, although we don't have audio for it, and that's from investigator Stanley Sutton. He testified at Joey's preliminary hearing that Marshall Smith had told him something slightly different. Stanley Sutton said there were two shots fired, and he's asked, question, were there two bullet holes in the back window? Answer, in talking with Marshall Smith with the police department, there was one that entered into the windshield, and it showed the entrance, and then one in his head. So to my understanding, there were two shots fired, or two shots into the vehicle itself. Which means that even if we set aside what the tow truck driver remembers, we still have three contradictory police reports to deal with. Actually, four versions, if you consider Marshall's memory in 2016, that he hadn't arrived until Terry Ferguson had the truck on his wrecker. Luckily, though, we have exactly one police report from the Rome Police Department that mentions this bullet hole. And hey, maybe that'll help us figure out what happened here. Or at least who found the window, right? Let's see what it says. Upon Lieutenant Burnett's arrival, she began her investigation of the accident scene and observed the condition of the truck, which included the finding of a back window from the truck. The window pane displayed an apparent bullet hole consistent with the point of entry from the outside in. After the initial collection of evidence and statements at the scene of the accident, Lieutenant Burnett notified Captain Marshall Smith of the circumstances discovered. During the course of the initial case investigation follow-up, Captain Smith arrived at the scene of the accident where he collected a rear glass window that was discovered as belonging to the white Toyota truck. The window came from the rear sliding glass window frame of the Toyota truck at the accident scene. Captain Smith secured this window as part of this investigation. So, yeah, no, that's not going to help. The police report says first that Lieutenant Burnett arrived at the crime scene and found the glass with the bullet hole and did an initial collection of evidence. And then in the very next paragraph, it says Marshall Smith arrived at the crime scene and found the rear glass window. So while this police report does a good job of having all its bases covered, it isn't much help in sorting between the various police accounts of what actually happened at the crime scene. That brings us to the photographs. This is one reason we initially had to doubt Terry Ferguson's memory. He didn't recall any photographer being at the scene that night. Not at all. But a photographer was called and photos were taken, which means Terry has to be wrong, right?
How he could have missed Clyde Collier, I don't know.
That's weird. I mean, wouldn't he have noticed that Collier wasn't there? Wouldn't that have been weird in itself?
Yeah, I guess so. It makes me question how much he actually remembers from the incident because, I mean, Clyde Collier was there taking pictures. Unless it wasn't Clyde Collier, but Marshall Smith says it was Clyde Collier.
That was Claire and I very early on in the investigation. As it turned out, though, the fact that Terry doesn't recall photographer Clyde Collier at the scene is less of a reason to doubt Terry than it initially appeared, because no one remembers Clyde Collier at the scene. I mean, someone was there and did take photos, many of them blurry and most poorly framed, but we don't really know who took them. Because, for instance, Captain Marshall Smith does not remember Clyde Collier being there.
The photographs that you were showing to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, did you take those photographs?
No, sir, I did not.
They were taken by Clyde Collier?
That is correct, sir.
What time did he arrive on the scene?
Don't know, sir.
Were you there when they were taken?
No, sir.
You were not there?
No, sir.
And so you don't know, do you know when he took the pictures?
He took them that night, but I don't know what time.
Okay. And do you know how many photographs were taken?
No, sir.
Could there have been 100?
No, with Mr. Collier, he probably took an enormous amount.
Okay. And you had already left when he arrived?
I don't remember seeing Mr. Collier there that night. It was somewhere either between the time that it had to be when I was going to the Florida Medical Center. Because when I got back, the tow truck just had arrived, and everything was still like it was when I left.
And Officer Hank Jackson doesn't remember Clyde Collier being there.
I guess Clyde Collier took a little picture. You'd think it would have been decent pictures.
Well, there seemed to be about... Well, everybody says he usually takes a ton of pictures.
Yep.
And we only have about 30.
He usually takes... It's almost like a video. I mean, he takes a lot.
So we're going to try and contact him and see if he can find the originals.
And Clyde Collier himself doesn't remember being there.
What happened with Clyde Collier? Didn't he talk?
Oh, he called me, yeah. And he said he'd resume. He didn't remember the case very well or at all. And he actually seemed to be saying like one of his assistants may have taken the photos. Yeah, I didn't know. I mean,
that might explain why Terry never saw Clyde out there.
Yeah. Well, no one saw Clyde because Marshall Smith says in his testimony at some point that he never saw Clyde out there either. And he assumed Clyde came when he was not around. But he said he'd keep looking after Christmas and he'd see what he could find. But he did confirm that there would be more than 20 photos. He's like, oh, I took much more than that. We always took lots of photos. I've been trying to figure out those photos too, and we just need more. There's not enough to figure out what's going on.
So even if no one remembers Clyde Collier being at the crime scene, everyone does remember that Clyde Collier takes a bajillion photos. So why then do we only have 17 photos that appear to have been taken by a photographer at the scene? I know Claire said 30, but that's generous. There are 17 at most, and that's even including a couple that it's hard to see how Collier could have taken. But of the photos we do have, a maximum of 17 could have possibly come from him. But after months of trying and failing to obtain additional photos from Mr. Collier, and receiving 1,000 assurances that he'd go grab them any moment now, nothing happened. So, about a month back, the GIP finally sent in a records request asking for these photos, because although Clyde Collier was a private photographer, he acted as a contractor for the Rome Police Department. He was called out to all the crime scenes, essentially. He took photos for them all the time. And under public records law, his work as a contractor is subject to these kind of requests. Well, the first response the state had was to deny it and say, nope, he's a private citizen. Photos he takes of the crime scene are not records that the defense is entitled to have. Claire wrote back, pointing out that actually he clearly very much meets the requirements of a contractor. And since then, all we've heard is that, well, Clyde Collier doesn't keep good records or keep organized records, so good luck finding him.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case that Claire should have access to those photos, and you can see that in their waffling and changing the position to say now the photos don't exist. But yeah, under existing law in Georgia and other jurisdictions, that would certainly be fair game for an Open Records or a Public Information Act request.
So that's what we know about the last known movements of the victim, Isaac Dawkins, about what the eyewitnesses to the events leading up to his death had to say, and about what the crime scene could tell us. But some of these things may or may not hold up during the course of the investigation, both the police investigation and our investigation. But for now, we do have a basic outline of what we believed happened the night that Isaac was shot. So it's time to turn our attention to Joey Watkins. Because remember, in the commission of a crime, it's not just about motive. It's also about opportunity. Next time on Undisclosed.
That wraps up episode 4, season 2 of Undisclosed, brought to you with the support of the Georgia Innocence Project. Visit their website at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org for more info on Joey's case. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Stamps.com and Blue Apron. Stamps.com is always good to us, but I have to give special credit to Blue Apron for continuing to supply me with the delicious ammunition I need to blast Rabia into culinary oblivion. That giant rice cooker will not save you, boss woman. Please remember that. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez did the theme music, Baluchiora Logo, Nina Musser, and Christy Williams on our website. That website, www.undisclosed-podcast.com. Never forget those beautiful people maps. They are designed by Heidi Phelps, as well as episode transcripts provided for those inclined to the written word. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the podcast Crime Writers On produces the show with help from Brooke Giddings and Hannah McCarthy. Methil Telhan has become the Uber producer. She controls all things Methil does, especially our Instagram. She wants you to send pictures of the pets of Undisclosed to our Instagram handle at UndisclosedPod. I'll be doing the same with mine, so don't miss out on that. As always, if you've got questions for John over at the Undisclosed Addendum, send them our way with the hashtag UDAddendum. But try to get them in before Tuesday morning, because that's when we record. Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson. He apologizes to our fans for holding his nose and speaking out of the side of his mouth in an effort to hide his Baltimore accent. He will see you next week for episode 5. Until then.